Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. I'm your host, Nick Bilton. I am very excited. I have two guests today. My first guest is a banana, and I'm not actually kidding about that. And my second guest is someone who works in the art world who was who had the guts to come on here and talk to me about the $120,000 banana duct taped to a wall this week in Miami. Stefan Simkowitz is now eating the banana as we sit here and talk. That's a piece of art, Stefan.
It's actually a very. I thought it was not ripe, but it's perfect.
It's perfect now. So,
do you mind if I have a bite?
You can eat. So Stefan is a Los Angeles-based art collector, art curator, and art advisor. He is very vocal on social media about all things related to art, culture, the economy, politics, you name it. He is also a very controversial figure. If you look him up, you will find lots of stories, even a huge magazine feature in the New York Times about his approach to discovering new artists. And he is, incredibly smart. I'm really excited to have a conversation with him about not just the banana, but about the economy, about politics, you name it. So as everyone else in the world, not just in the art world, but in the world, saw this week. And we're going to talk.
Can you hear the sound of a banana being eaten?
Of a $120,000 banana being eaten? I'm sure you can. He's literally eating the banana.
He gave me a cheap banana tonight.
We all looked at this piece of art, if you want to call it that, and thought it was the most ludicrous, ridiculous, moronic thing on earth. And yet you think you have a different point of view. So I want to hear what your point of view is.
Who's we all? Speak for yourself. There are many people who think it's a brilliant act. Maurizio Catalan has not exhibited a new work in quite a long time. And this banana was just so perfect and instant, an artwork, the ready-made iconic work of the social media era, sort of his riff on Duchamp's urinal. I mean, it's a masterpiece. I wish I had it. I wish I owned it.
Would you really pay $120,000 for a regular banana duct taped to a wall?
Well, no, not a regular banana duct taped to a wall, but Maurizio Catalan's banana taped to a wall, I certainly would.
Can you explain this to me? In for someone who doesn't understand this. So here's, I went down the rabbit hole. I was like, okay, I'm going to kind of be a little open-minded about this and try to look at this as a,
I'm now halfway through Nick Bilton's banana that probably cost him 85 cents.
It's an organic banana, so maybe a little more, maybe 95 cents.
Potassium rich.
And so I went down this rabbit hole. I read all this stuff about it and everyone's viewpoint, and I can't even believe I did that because that in itself was a little ludicrous. But I came across the art critic from the New York Times who wrote a defense of the banana. And his defense of the banana made me hate the whole fucking thing even more. And his defense was that while the artist is clearly kind of making fun of the world, of the art world, by doing this, the fact that he used duct tape, and he is someone who hangs things in his artwork, he's hung, when he did his retrospective, I think in 2011, he hung most of his artwork
but
from the ceiling.
I don't think his intention is to make fun of the art world.
The art critic for the New York Times called Banksy a joke and a prankster and said that he is that our banana artist is a very serious artist and this is a very serious piece of art.
Totally serious. And Maurizio Catalan is not trying to make fun of anyone. There's nothing cynical or nasty about the gesture of the banana. He's not saying, look how stupid you are to fall for this trick. It's actually a celebration of the object of sculpture in relationship to how it performs within a group, and that group being today the visitors of Art Basel Miami and all the people who see the image and experience it on social media. It's a celebration of the conceptual practice of making art, and it's brilliant. It's also devoid of any moral structure. It doesn't have a moral position. It doesn't preach. It doesn't tell people to think this thing or that thing. It's non-ideological. It's not partisan. Republicans can like the banana, and Democrats can like the banana sculpture. It's not suggesting.
And they can both hate it equally.
Yeah, and it's done in such a simple, inexpensive, direct, and immediately iconic. I would wish I could have bought this banana.
So, do you think that the outrage towards the banana was more that it was just a banana stuck to a wall with a piece of duct tape, or that we are, as we're looking at the presidential election, you know, and the cycle that we're going through right now, that inequality is top of mind? We all, you know, everyone's anti-billionaire and anti-capitalism and this, that, and the other. Does that play more of a role, do you think, in the response to it, or is it just in the same way as Duchamp's urinal?
No. Well, I think the ignorant, of which there are many, non-ideologically speaking, are always fascinated with this conspiracy of art. Their entry point to art is a conspiracy. It's expensive, but it's really worthless. And the ignorant are always fascinated by this. And the press, essentially, their primary audience is the ignorant, unfortunately. And this is a very sort of maybe elitist, snobbish thing to say, but so they tend to feed into this, and they sort of say, well, a banana sold for $120,000. You can buy it at Whole Foods for $1.29, or you can buy it at Costco for 80 cents or whatever. And they sort of feed into this conspiracy, but it functions on so many levels. The Catalan, and I think Duchamp as well, you know, utilize the participant, the viewer, the people who engage with the object to take the artwork and project it into time and space, to transform it into something that is actually meaningful, that is distributed, that is experienced as a cultural artifact. And it's a very sophisticated and complex thing that happens. And Duchamp talks about it in his great speech he made, I think, in 1956, called The Creative Act, where he talks about the sort of transformation of an object of art that's created by a creator and then is sort of taken over by an audience and transformed through time and space by the spectator. He calls it posterity. And I urge all your listeners, if to turn this podcast off and to listen. And to listen to Duchamp's speech, as you can find on Spotify, called The Creative Act. And listen to it 10 times, because it'll really explain this action to you.
But what is the significance? So when he says, okay, I'm going to stick this banana on a wall with a piece of duct tape, right? And I'm going to call this comedian. The part that I have a hard time understanding from the art perspective is that he says it's worth between $120,000 and $150,000.
The artist doesn't say what it's worth. His dealer, Emmanuel Perrotin, decides what it's worth. He sets the price.
But don't you think did you talk to him about this? Did you?
I didn't, but I don't think Catalan would particularly care whether it's $10,000 or $20,000 or $1 million or $500,000. You know, it's like any other artwork. It has a price based on his resume, his market participation. And it's a relatively fair price for this work. It's actually, I think it's actually quite cheap. I would have probably charged double.
I can't tell if you're being serious.
I'm being dead serious. I think $120,000 for this piece is a bargain.
Okay. So when you look at the response from the ignorance, as you want to call them, right?
Not the ignorant, the people who don't understand art, and instead of making the effort to study and think and read, they immediately have this reaction of say, oh, it's ridiculous. You know, if you actually take the time and you study World War II, if you're interested in history, and you're going to read a lot of books about World War II, you're going to watch a lot of documentaries. People don't do that with art. They just sort of say, well, my experience is I don't understand it, therefore it's bad, therefore it's not art. But very few people approach art as something that actually maybe is interesting to study, is interesting to engage in a deeper way.
But isn't part of that that art is so fucking expensive these days, and that a banana duct tape to a wall costs $120,000?
No, art is not expensive. Art is actually quite cheap.
I mean, look.
In fact, you know, some art is expensive. Catlin certainly deserves to be expensive because he's been exhibiting and showing for 25 years, and his work has fetched $15 million at auction, $10 million at auction. He's at museum shows all over the world, gallery shows. He's one of the great artists living on the planet. No, in relative to who Maurizio Catlin is, that work is not particularly expensive. And art is not inaccessible. It's very accessible. I just came from UCLA Open Studios, where a very talented group of people was just graduating. And you can go there and you can buy work for $1,000, $2,000. You can negotiate directly with the artist and get really good work. You just have to make the effort to engage in it. So there's no conspiracy out there. What the conspiracy is that people are not willing to engage in culture. They're not that interested. They say they're interested, but they're not really.
Do you think, and you and I have talked about this before, but do you think that we went through this transition in art and art history where at first your technique and your skill meant everything, and now that means absolutely nothing? Is this just the top of the pyramid of that?
It's not the top of a pyramid. I mean, skill is we've gone through many periods of history with art. The Egyptians during the Old Kingdom, during the first sort of early years of the kingdom, produced most of the great art they ever produced, the great pyramids. Most of the great work was produced in the Old Kingdom, you know, at the early stages. And then for the next 3,000 years, they just had craftsmen copy the same stuff in different shapes and sizes, but the same language. They never really innovated from them. They never even considered these people to be artists. Art has gone through many phases throughout history. Today, we look at the ancient Egypt and we think of it as art. Back then, they didn't even have a word to describe that. Art is a really strange thing. And today, where we are in the 20th century, the skill of making a painting per se or carving a sculpture in stone is something that we understand en masse because it requires certain formal skills. How do you build a table or a chair? Same way. But there is skill to coming up with the conceptual idea as simple and elegant as taking a banana, taking some duct tape and putting it on art fair at this moment in time precisely, on that wall precisely, in this gesture, in this particular moment in history. It's almost like, have you ever tried to catch a fly with your hand when it's annoying you, when you're like in bed at
I'm
night?
I'm really good at, I have one of the tennis rackets. But
have you ever done it where you can't find the racket and you just like,
yeah.
And sometimes you catch the fly and you're like, damn, I just caught the fly.
I'm good.
It's kind of like that. Sometimes art is like that. It's not a classical skill. It's not a skill that you might recognize, but there is an intellectual skill. It's like telling a good joke. You know, some people just tell a great joke you laugh.
But you can tell a good joke. You can read a good book. You can watch a good movie or create these things, right? And there is a consensus in society that these things are good. Some people may dislike them, but for the most part, there are certain things where a majority...
Oh, so consensus means it's good.
No. My question is, I haven't finished my question yet. My question is when it comes to these conceptual pieces like the banana, it seems that the people within the art world look at it as this great thing that has, you know, no one has ever thought of before. And people outside the artwork are like, huh? What the fuck is that?
They all look at it. They all experience it. They're all fascinated by it. They're all taken in by it.
Why do you think there's been such a backlash to this particular piece?
There hasn't been a backlash. There's been...
It's been on literally the cover of the Post and, it was memeified. So people were duct taping oranges to their cubicles and calling it art. I mean, there has been a modern day backlash. It's not like they're storming the castle.
That's not a backlash.
What is that?
That is almost a deification of the object. It's an ascendancy of the successful artwork into the realms of popular culture. it's the opposite of a backlash. It might read like a backlash to you, but this work of art has immediately, almost instantaneously ascended into the realms of masterpiece. It took Duchamp's urinal decades to make that climb. Now it happens overnight, and that's really interesting, because what's happened is the spectator, the viewer, the ignorant masses, the intellectual masses, the people who understand, have cumulatively constructed an engagement with an artwork that has immediately been able to transform it into an ascendant iconic work of art. Fascinating. Why? Social media. Social media has taken that posterity, that time that it has taken artworks to cook to become masterpieces, for artworks to enter the sort of the status of globally known, iconic, and it's compressed it into seconds. And the masterful stroke of this piece is it's really the first conceptual object that has achieved this with such elegance and simplicity, bereft of the woke moralizing culture that has sort of invaded the art world and culture industry. It's done so in such a precise way. It's fantastic. I'm so excited by this banana.
Even the couple that bought it thought it was ridiculous.
They thought it's ridiculous because they're supposed to say it's ridiculous.
Because they don't want to be seen
because
as
giving
a shit.
Because they don't want to be seen as elitist. They want to be like, oh, it's so stupid. We bought this banana. We're really rich people. We're billionaires. And look, billionaires are so stupid. We went and we bought the banana because we're dumbass rich people. But they're actually probably quite sophisticated. And they probably, when they go to bed at night, understand this construct. But they don't want to seem like they do. They want to say, oh, we were so stupid. This was fine. We're just billionaires throwing our money away in a banana. But it's not. They acquired one of the most important pieces produced in the last decade.
I have a hard time keeping a straight face when you say that, but I can take your argument and it registers. Don't necessarily agree with you. I think that there are pieces I have seen, pieces of work in the last decade that stand out to me as greater, but I understand what you're saying. I'm not sure I agree with it, and I would think most of the people...
But the piece also registers the sort of...
I love that you're pointing at the banana ate the flaccid, as,
yeah, well,
as the...
At least to have some potassium. But it registers as something that sort of he sort of intuited that social media would...
You think he did? You think he knew that...
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what's the difference between this being...
Catalan is not doing this by mistake. He is a surgeon. This is someone as precise as one of the greatest engineers on the planet. This is a surgical procedure. That's unbelievable.
But is it a
this
surgical
isn't like,
procedure?
I'm going to see what happens after not exhibiting a work for 15 years if I put a banana on a wall taped in Miami Basel. This is someone who is totally aware and in control of his craft and the ensuing chaos that it would bring to him. Completely. This is the skill of Catalan.
Do you think that Is it a commentary on society, or is it a...
It's not a commentary on society. He's not even saying... He's not even saying to society, look how dumb you are.
What is he saying?
He's an artist. He's saying art is alive. Art is well. Art is breathing. In this world we live in today where there's so much anxiety and negativity and so much conflict and so much hate and poverty and inequality, he's saying art is alive. It's living, it's breathing, it's very much here. It's a very positive thing that he's done here. There's no cynicism in this action. There's no like, look how stupid you are, you bought my banana.
But there is cynicism in this action. If you're talking about inequality, which is what you just said for a brief second there, if you're watching... Let's just say, for example, that...
He's celebrating art's ability to cut across every single sort of parallel and cross-section of society. Whether people engage with it as an object that this is so stupid, someone paid $120,000 for a banana. That's their choice.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations, sparking movements, and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new three-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterized the early years of Black Twitter, to the social movements, the voices, and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.
As a society, right, don't you think that we should collectively be looking at when you have rampant poverty, you have the chaos that's happening, you know, right now all around us from here to Timbuktu and back, you know, this backlash against billionaires for a reason, that we should climate change, so on and so forth, that paying $120,000 for this is, don't you think that spits in the face of that in some respects or no?
Unrelated.
How is it unrelated?
This is the question that one would receive from a young junior priest being trained in the Spanish Inquisition to basically bring the devil out of innocent people before they get crucified. This is very dangerous thinking, Nick, especially from a journalist who's so present.
I'm just pushing you. I'm not saying I agree with all the things coming out of my mouth.
This is the beginning of the Spanish Inquisition. This is the beginning of moralizing confusion. No, nothing. The banana has nothing to do with poverty and inequality. This is not a vessel through which all people can carry their ills. They're separate questions and they must be discussed and thought separately. They have to be passed out separately. You can't engage in the banana as the problem with rich people. It's not. This banana is the amazing ascendancy of art in a world like this, that art, look at this thing.
He's holding the banana.
I'm holding and shaking it in Nick's face. Is that art still lives, that it cannot be destroyed, no matter how stupid, no matter how bad things may be perceived to be, that it's a profoundly positive gesture. It's got nothing to do with any of the things you talked about, environmental degradation, the ills of capitalism.
No, but if you're, I think I'm just channeling what the things I've read. So, and there's been backlash from every corner of
a lot of bad writing.
A lot of bad writing,
and that really pathetic attempt from the performance artist to eat the banana. I mean, that people have jumped on. I mean,
I'm not even going to go with it. Yeah. I thought that was. I mean, it was funny, sure. It was an extension of the art, if you want to call it that. But
you know, I might take the subject if we can.
Sure.
Your viewers might not be aware of this, but across the channel in England recently, they give the Turner Prize. This is this fancy prize given to a British artist. And this is sort of parallel sort of stories, big stories in the art world that happened this week. And there were four artists up for the prize. And it's a prize that the Tate gives. And the artists got together and they went to the jury and they said, none of us can win the prize. We're all equal. We're all equal. We will only accept the prize if we all get the prize together. So you have this kind of like art world activity of like total woke moralizing, like there's no winners and losers. Then you have this Catalan banana kind of like across the pond in Basel, Miami, that kind of like cuts through the entire art world like a hot knife through butter and just boom, right to the heart and kind of like just takes it all over. And I think Catalan's gesture to me is avoids so many of these conversations of like who has the moral high ground or low ground. It doesn't even necessarily discuss the issue of morality. It's not intent. Art's purpose its intention isn't to be ideological necessarily or political. Its purpose is to be art. Art is itself something that is unique, and the ready-made, as created by Duchamp in the urinal, which is the most, probably, in my opinion, important artwork of the 20th century, is the precursor to Andy Warhol's ripping of images of newspapers and mass-produced in silkscreen. The ready-made, the idea of taking something that is there and taking it out of its original context, taking a urinal out of its context and putting it in a museum, or taking a banana out of its context with duct tape and putting it as a saleable object, is one of the sort of profound, powerful actions of conceptual art of the 20th century that move art forward from this sort of skill-based work that sort of...
Wait, I want to interrupt you for a second. You have this... There's another...
Remind me to talk about Malevich in a second.
Okay, I will remind you to talk about Malevich in a second. But there's another thing that you talked to me about before we started recording, which was the egg on Instagram. And it is the most liked image in the history of Instagram. It surpassed Kim Kardashian and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And you have some theories about that. Tell us what your thoughts are.
It was just an exercise in collective banality. You know, a sort of these guys who I don't know who did it, but they put an egg on Instagram and like collectively said, let's all get together on social media and make this the most liked image in the world.
So I have a question. In the era that we live in today, where everything is connected and everyone is connected, why is it that the banality of an egg or a banana is the thing that stands out?
Well, I think they function in two different ways. The egg functions specifically as sort of a social media phenomena. I suppose it conceptually could be considered a work of art in a sense, but I think it addresses the sort of the idea that engagement is in itself something that is meaningful. And this has its inherent problems.
Which are
it takes an audience and it suggests that there is no responsibility or personal responsibility to think beyond the surface of what you immediately experience. So it is almost a free pass that you receive to not think or consider. And this is a broader problem in society.
What do you mean? Go on. You mean a broader problem in society as a whole, or in-
as a whole. It's sort of the lack of personal responsibility in our actions, whether as consumers, as individuals, and our ability to experience things by liking something, supporting something, but really not changing our personal actions. Is a problem. I mean, society certainly faces problems today, as it always has been.
Well, you and I have talked a lot about, I'm going to kind of transition this away from the banana for a minute. We may come back to it. It is still sitting on the table. But you and I have talked a lot about the economy, consumerism. We've talked about the fact that there are some people out there, you don't believe this, but there are some people out there that believe that capitalism, it's coming to the end of its life. And there are others that believe that this is just, you know, having four of the richest people in the world have the same amount of wealth as about 3.6 billion is just, you know, part and parcel for it all. What are your beliefs as to kind of where we are in, you know, when you talk about what you were just referring to, where you... people are liking an egg because everyone else is liking the egg and so on, how that relates to consumerism. You know, talk about what you were talking about earlier with me.
Well, I think how it relates to consumerism. I mean, I think the evils of mankind have always been the evils of mankind. They've always been similar. They've always been driven by selfishness, vanity, stupidity, and historically they've been quite consistent. It's just today we're all connected and there are many more of us. So in aggregate, there's probably just a lot more stupidity than there was 500 years ago because there's 7 billion people versus 500 million people. So your aggregate amount of stupidity is much greater, and therefore the actions that such a mass of stupid decisions make is very bad for the environment, is degrading for interpersonal relationships. How we mediate this globally, this is the big question of our time. But we certainly don't do it by fighting with each other. We don't do it by having rancid disagreements with each other. We do it by collaboration And perhaps, and I'm just thinking, you know, as much as the egg and the liking of the egg and making it the most popular image on Instagram is a banal act, it's also an act of human collaboration at scale that is non-ideological.
But why can't we, if we can at scale create the most liked image on Instagram being just a boring old egg, why is it that we at scale can't do things to try to solve the problems that have come about as a result of consumerism and capitalism and so on?
Maybe we are. You know,
how?
I think maybe they happen slowly. You know, for example, I look at meat consumption, which is down in America, up in China and India. But there has been a campaign through social media, very effective, through PETA and other organizations, which promote animal cruelty as one of the great evils of our time. And meat consumption has actually declined in the United States of America on a per capita basis. So I think I'm a little more, you know, I'm sort of a combination of negative and positive, but I think that the powers of human collaboration are quite powerful, and it's just that they happen at scale and at a duration that is sometimes imperceptible to us because we focus on the bad things because it's easier to sort of look at the bad and not the good. So we sort of invaded by sort of the narrative of badness. But I think there's a lot of goodness, a lot of moves towards sort of positive collaboration that is good for the world. I'm not as negative in my outlook.
Do you think that at some point we are going to get to a point where there will be a backlash to all of this, the technology, the consumerism, the collectivism that is kind of somewhat taking place on, you know, the fact that, you know, one of the things I find so fascinating now, when you look at cancel culture, for example, it is something that it is binary. It used to be before that, like, a small group of people could disagree with you.
It's always been binary. If you were black in the rural South in the 1800s, you were canceled. If you were Native American Indian, you were canceled. Cancel culture has always been binary. It's just been democratized now, and it's been distributed evenly across platforms of social media. So it's become more difficult to define because it's not defined based on race or gender or identity. It's based on sort of micro communities or micro definitions. We have a democratization of cancel culture.
But it's also become a, in the same way that, how many people have liked that egg? Is it, what, it was like
a lot.
30 billion? I don't know. No, I'm just kidding. It's not 30 billion
lot,
people.
Like,
millions and millions, tens of millions. There's been this kind of collectivist viewpoint where everyone, it's, you know, Twitter mobs, disagreements about, you know, about the liberal viewpoints versus conservative. They have, everything has become more binary than they have before. They used to be more nuanced. They used to be more gray. And it seems like that's gone away. I mean, you're the only person I know who actually likes the banana, to be quite honest. But in most instances,
it doesn't mean that I'm wrong. It means I'm the only person who likes the banana. You know, you cannot deduce because there's only one person who likes the banana that they're wrong. There are periods in society where everyone is wrong and few are right.
It's true.
And we're in one of those periods, probably.
In what respect?
You know, it depends on what side of the aisle we are. We're sitting here in sort of nice place in West Hollywood, comfortable. But, you know, there's a lot of people who are in very different positions. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, honestly, I think that's what, you know, that's what bothers me about the banana, to come back to the banana, is that, let's just hypothetically speaking, right? We live in a town. Let's just say it's a town of 100 people, right? And there are 98 people who can't eat. They have no food. They have nowhere to sleep and so on. And one of the people of the two people that can eat and have food decides to sell a banana as a piece of artwork for all of the money that could have fed those 98
people. It's such an infantile argument.
No, it's not an infantile
argument. It's infantile because if you go to LAX and you go to the terminal of international flights, you will find waiting in line people at first class, getting on their first class seats that cost $12,000 a seat to fly 8 hours.
That's how much it is for first class?
So in the first class cabin of one of 1,000 planes leaving LAX, some people are spending $120,000 to be more comfortable for 8 hours while they fly to London. So this idea of the banana carrying all the ills of globalization consumption is absurd. The conspiracy of art is not that great. The conspiracy of consumption is far greater.
Yes, I completely agree with you. And I'm trying to get you to talk about the conspiracy of consumption.
The conspiracy of consumption is teenage girls buying that lipstick, that stuff that fills the lips from Kylie Jenner and spending billions on the stuff. That's the real conspiracy. The conspiracy is not Maurizio Catalan's banana that actually represents that actually art, conceptual art, sculpture is living, breathing, that it can't be killed by this consumerism. This is a gesture that art can survive this consumerist killing machine. That art can somehow, this stupid banana that you buy in a store and a piece of duct tape can go way over all of this stuff. And that's what we should be criticizing.
The consumerism.
The consumerism, the concept, the deification of people who are considered because they're beautiful or wealthy. And Catalan's banana sort of plays with this gesture because this is how these systems are distributed today. The lipsticks, the bloggers, the influencers, they're all peddling some kind of meaningless consumption that kind of or some horrible thing that really you don't need. But the banana is actually art. You can't sell it. You can't buy millions of it. It's a conceptual gesture that sort of that does so much in the social media era.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
3, 2, 1. Political Breakdown is a daily politics podcast from KQED in San Francisco that goes deep into the issues you care about. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Look, 2024 is gonna get weird.
Who decides when there's been an insurrection or not?
We're still in the innovation phase of AI.
And that is where you see that they're not actually being equitable and trying to build a utopia where we can all use drugs happily together.
But whatever happens this election year, the KQED Politics team is in this with you. Political Breakdown. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
What you keep talking about the social media era, why is it such a big relevant part?
Because we're
this?
In an epoch. We're in a very particular era. The onslaught and the integration of social media into society is essentially a historical epoch in which we live. It reconstructs society. It reconstructs how we're connected, how we communicate.
In a good way or a bad way?
Both good and bad.
Do you think more good or more bad?
Equal.
Really?
Equal, very positive in some respects, very negative in other respects. I work with a lot of artists on the continent of Africa. I work with artists who can't get visas to America. I work with artists whose work would never be seen because they can't socialize and hobnob with the people at fancy galleries or institutions or openings. They've been able to have their work seen globally because of social media. They've been able to connect with me because of social media and with others. They've been able to find a voice because of social media. Many people in Africa who I work with without social media would not even have a smidgen of a chance of survival. Yes, for good and bad, like every system.
But there are some systems that are worse than better. And, you know, I sometimes think that a lot of the technologies we see today have a little more worse than better.
Not, the technologies may not be worse or better. How people use them might be worse or better. And how monopoly capitalism has allowed those people who control those companies and those technologies may be problematic.
Maybe. Is.
Is. Is problematic and also good. There's a lot of good that comes out of it. There's a lot of bad that comes out of it. Bill Gates was widely criticized. I just watched the great documentary on Bill Gates. I thought it was very well done. And if you look at the work Bill Gates has done, it's exceptional. It's extraordinarily complex. It's far-reaching. So I'm not sure if I agree with that.
You don't agree? Well, but
I'm not going to say Mark Zuckerberg's a bad guy. I'm not going to say Bill Gates is a bad guy. I'm not going to say Bezos is a bad guy. They probably do bad things and they probably do good things. They probably do great things and very bad things equally. No individual can do just black and white. That this idea of good and evil.
I agree with you completely.
So you know, I can't sit here and say they're evil because of this. There is evil. There is waste. There are a lot of things that happen that are unfortunate, and we need a government that can legislate professionally to correct these things so they don't overreach, and that's what we don't have. We don't have a working government with a sophisticated legislative body that is working together to fix these problems. That's the real problem. It's not that these people are the master evils of the universe. It's that our government, our ability to collaborate as people. And coming back to that stupid egg that has so many viewers, the more I think about it, it actually is kind of interesting that all these people got together and liked an egg. And if I think about it, it's actually maybe not so banal. Maybe it's great. All these people, all different races, colors, classes, probably got together and they collaborated and they achieved something together. It's actually probably a beautiful thing when I think about it a little more. Maybe it's not as banal as I thought it was originally.
Is it as equally as impressive as the banana?
Not for me, because the banana, because I'm an art dealer and I'm an art collector and I'm a supporter of the arts. And the egg is something different. The egg is a sort of... It functions differently. It's not necessarily a conceptual art piece. For me, the banana is a museum grade work.
One of the things that
it's sort of almost like the Mona Lisa of our age. In fact, probably
the banana is the Mona Lisa of our age.
In fact, if you hang it next to the Mona Lisa in Paris, you'd probably get people lining up to take pictures of it.
Well, Art Basel, they had to pull it from the show because too many people were lining up to take pictures of the banana.
The two most famous artworks of the last few years are Salvatore Mundi and the banana.
Hold on a second. Wait, I'm going to interrupt you here. If people lined up to see the Mona Lisa, partially because it's so famous, of course.
Because it's famous. It was stolen. It was stolen. They had a great story in Paris in the 1920s or
10s. But you line up, you walk through, you know, you walk through the Museum of Modern Art or, you know, or in New York, or you walk through the, you know, any of the great museums, and you look at a John Singer Sargent and you think like, that is an incredible piece of artwork that this person perfected over time. You look at like a Thomas Eakins, you look at any of these, even the more contemporary.
Because you've seen a lot of figurative
work. No, because I think
work.
You can appreciate them for what they are.
But if you listen to a piece of music by John Cage, you might be bored out of your mind. You might not understand because you don't hear music like that often, but you understand what color and figuration looks like.
Right.
And most people grew up on it, so they're used to it. Just like if you give people who've never had sushi before uni the first time out, they're going to throw up. Sometimes things take a little getting used to, and then you have uni a few times, and you're like, wow, can you get me the uni?
Saying that the future of art is the banana?
The future of art is no one knows. That's the great thing about it. No one knows what the future of anything
is. I'm just arguing that I don't think that the Mona Lisa and a banana taped to a wall with duct tape are equal.
They're not unequal.
All right. So I talk to a lot of people and for my job, and a lot of economists and authors and even people in tech and venture capitalists and so on, even among them, believe that, to come back to this, you know, consumerism, capitalism, that we're kind of at this point in time where things feel like they may break, and that the inequality that
we're not at a point where they may break. They have broken, and they've broken for many people. They might not have broken for us yet, but
correct.
For many people,
yes,
across the country, things have broken, and they are broken down. So, you know.
But you think that this is just par for the course and everything's going to be just fine, or do you not?
I don't know what the future is, but I mean, I have.
But you're as someone who has studied a lot of history about the way the world we live in and so on. What is your belief about what the future looks like based on the present and the current climate and so on and so forth?
I think like all times, we'll go through very dark phases and very light phases of peace and light. But I think there are challenges, but nothing that is so unique or specific to our historical experience as human beings. We're still here. We're still generally at peace with each other, largely speaking. There is huge inequality. There always has been.
Well, it's gotten worse.
I mean, it depends if you were, a slave in ancient Greece. It depends what time. And gotten worse under what time scale? Gotten worse from the 50s when things were so great, or from the 60s or the 70s when things were fantastic? It's like this idea that we're special, we're unique. Our experience is we are the generation experiencing the worst. We're the best generation because our experience is worse than the prior. We're special. We're not special. We are going through a period, like many periods in history, where we are challenged by complex things. People were challenged by World War II. That was serious. World War I. There have been many, many challenges historically. There's nothing unique or exceptional about our experience. There's no great poverty is not greater than past generations.
The difference between our experience right now and the experience of the past is that
we've never experienced the past experiences that there are experiences.
Well, but also for society as a whole, is that the changes we're going through and the changes we're about to go through are happening
rapidly.
At a rapid pace, unlike anything we've ever seen.
There's been an acceleration, which is one of the conditions of this time.
And I think that it's only going to accelerate quicker and further and faster.
100%.
And that is what worries me. I don't think there's anything you can do about it, honestly. I think that if society got together in the same way they wanted to like an egg and got together to have a conversation about this, it would maybe slow things down. But
let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Do you commute? You don't commute to work, do you?
I'm sitting in my okay. I do go to co-working space.
When you fly to London, would you prefer to be able to get there in an hour rather than eight?
However, I will say this. I would prefer to get there in an hour rather than eight. Yes. But if it meant that I was going to be flying over a society where, 50 million people had lost their jobs as a result of that, and that were living in extreme poverty because of automation, I would be like, maybe we should, get there in eight or get there in six and have a conversation about it. And I think that that's what's lacking.
So what many people do is they link progress with poverty.
What do you mean?
They link technological progress with poverty. We're reaching this time where we're sort of thinking about this link between progress and poverty. We're saying, well, there's progress, therefore progress generates excessive amounts of capitalism, and therefore that creates excessive amounts of poverty. We really need to separate the conversations out and sort of analyze each body and each system separately and differently. We can't conflate them with each other, because then we're going to make very bad decisions about how to rectify problems, how to fix problems. Progress is good. Poverty is bad. Inequality is bad. But they're linked together in different ways. Consumerism, excess consumerism creates waste. Consumption that's wasteful is bad because it degrades the environment. Capitalism in its purest state, in my opinion, is a good system. Capitalism that is corrupted and corroded by corruption,
but
stupidity, and waste is bad.
There's corruption. That is humanity. There's corruption. There's always going to be someone who's going to take advantage of the system. So the capitalism in its pure state is impossible.
Anything in its pure state is impossible. That's why there's this sort of warp and weft, as Alan Watts used to say, this moving in and balance and out of balance. This movement, this conflict, this movement is what creates balance. I watch these stupid TV shows with my son. It's called Brain Games. It makes me watch them at night. And I was watching one the other day. They do this really dumb thing. They take a group of 20 people and they take a big gumball machine. I'm sure many of you, her parents, have been tortured by having to watch this. And they say to the 20 people, guess how many gumballs are in the machine? Everyone makes a guess. One guy says 300. Another guy says 6,000. And you know what they do? They take an average of all 20 people's guesses of how many gumballs were in the machine, and it comes to 2,650. And that average is 16 gumballs off from how many gumballs in the machine. It's really an amazing experiment, and you can do it with your friends. So somehow this collective inequality, this collective thinking that it can be, one guy can think there's 10,000 Gumballs, another 300, somehow comes up with a measure that is completely correct. It's a fantastic, simple statistical thing. So I think globally as a society, we're collectively much smarter than we give ourselves credit for, as long as we accept our differences and engage together and don't get too sort of anxious and separated to disengage and sort of get violent and do stupid things. You know, we have to be very measured, very positive. We have to think about things in ways that are distinct. We have to isolate the problems, think about them almost like our professional government legislator would think, and fix them in a very local way.
We have about 10 minutes left, but I want to ask you, I want to get back to art for a second. And one of the things that I've wondered a lot about, I read a lot of these McKinsey reports and government reports about automation and job inequality and all these, and how jobs are going to vanish and so on. And what's so fascinating is that the creative jobs that are going to be affected. And so right now, if you pick up a newspaper and you go to the sports section, there's probably a couple of stories in there that are written by AI. So it's like the Yankees won on Friday in the top of the ninth by, as Derek Jeter scored whatever. And the same thing happens with business stories, like Apple stock fell 3 points based on this side or the other. That's the very, very, very minor version of it. The future of that, of course, is going to be maybe you'll pick up there won't be a newspaper. Maybe you'll go online to read the news in 10, 20 years, whatever it is, and 10% of the stories will be written by humans and the other 90% by algorithms. People are, there's reports about how it's going to, editors in Hollywood, this, that, and the other, you'll be able to walk into your home. The vision Amazon probably has is that you walk into your home and you say, "Hey, Alexa, I want to watch a movie that's 20 minutes long with two women leads in New York, and it's a comedy because I have to leave for dinner in 20 minutes. When automation and AI or whatever you want to call it starts to make art, what does that look like in your mind?
You know, it's funny. I bought an artwork made by an AI piece. It was a Google researcher made this piece made by AI. It's a video piece, and I actually bought it about 3 years ago. It looks very beautiful.
But is there a definition of, what becomes art based on is it the person who writes the algorithm who made it? Is it the algorithm itself?
This is the great.
And I'm genuinely asking. I don't have an answer to this.
This is the great promise of art that we don't know, but it will come and it will be unexpected and it will be simple and it will be effective. I think this Google video was kind of amazing. It randomized a collection of images, and it's a very beautiful piece aesthetically. And the creator, is. I forgot his name even, and I don't even think his name is important, but I think art always redefines itself. We've gone historically from the Great Pyramids of Giza to the banana duct tape on a wall in Art Basel. We've come a long way. And I think
some would say, and we've not come a long way.
And I think we're going to go even further. So I think,
next year it'll just be the duct tape.
These are the things that, automation, could very well in somehow create some conceptual art, and people are playing with those ideas. I mean, many people, Antoine Catala, I know many artists thinking about these things and producing artwork with these themes.
Do you think about like what that world may look like? Is there a world where eventually there'll be a retrospective at the MoMA that's written that AI had created the whole thing?
I hope so. I hope to God, yes. I think that would be great.
When you look at the fact that there are
that,
now...
That will show mankind's advancement and, our moving forward. I hope we see all these things.
And do you think that there will be a point where
the skill that, well, skill.
I certainly hope we don't see people building pyramids and worshiping the dead again, like the ancient Egyptians who spend 33% of all their GDP on the death industry. I certainly hope we go forward and not backwards.
No, I'm just curious of who creates it, whose name is on it, because the name that's on it is...
It doesn't matter. I mean, you look at African tribal sculpture.
Oh, hold on a second. It doesn't matter. How can you say it doesn't matter when you say that the reason that the banana costs $120,000 is because of the artist's name on it? If I tried to sell you a banana for $120,000, you would tell me to go fuck myself.
Because in this case, it matters. But in indigenous cultures and tribal cultures, a lot of art production in Indian tantric drawings were made uncredited. The author was not important. The object was important. Its function, whether an African funerary sculpture was important, in Indian tantric drawings, families made them uncredited. So in indigenous cultures and tribal cultures, authorship is not as important. And this from a Western point of view, interestingly, the West has sort of demoted some of these works because they haven't fetishized the creator. So they've sort of demoted the value of works that are created that are non-attributed to an individual who is iconicized through a Western lens. But the great thing about art, it's produced in every corner of the earth in every way. And it expresses itself in different ways, and it emerges and then sort of is able to sort of stay there through time and space.
But there's a theory in music history that the reason that we actually had Bach and all these incredible musicians for over the last few centuries is because their name was tied to the work and they felt the need. And that's why you don't look at the work from, you know, 1,000 years ago in Africa. There is no...
Well, in music theory, Bach and Beethoven and Mozart were very brilliant. They had unique aesthetic qualities to their music.
They were brilliant, but they also pushed the boundary forward from what was there before.
Sure.
Right? And so my question is when you look at the fact that if you're saying that art is not consumerism, right?
Art can be consumerism, absolutely. A lot of art is consumerism. Banksy's consumerism, Shepard Fairey's consumerism, causes is consumerism. So art is consumed 100%. A lot of art is consumed. There's a lot of good art consumed. There's a lot of very bad art consumed. Art is like an emotion, as Duchamp would say. There's no such thing as something. There's good emotion. There's a bad emotion. There's an indifferent emotion. And yes, art is consumed in good, bad, and different forms by many different people.
So when we get to a point where an AI is creating the art that hangs in the MoMA, mm-hmm. and there's no name attached to it, what's the value? Is the value based on the number of people that want it? Is it the...
I don't know. The media has a sort of an obsession with discussing value.
Well, because it's
the only metric that everyone understands. People understand money. That's the only thing they understand because they're not willing to do the hard work to understand anything beyond money. So it's like a coat is a coat, whether it's on a hook or not, but the hook is the money that most people who write about art can hang the coat on. So they write about money and its value. Who cares what the value is? It might be worthless.
But I think that...
But if an AI creates a successful artwork and it's hanging in MoMA, it'll be a great thing.
What's funny is that you want to diss the society as a whole because they are obsessed with the value financially.
I'm not dissing society as a whole.
No, but what did you call them before? The
ignorant masses.
The ignorant mass as a whole, but what the ignorant mass is doing, it's laughing at the billionaire who spent $120,000 on the banana or $100 million on that fancy car or whatever it is. So it's
the only people are laughing are the ignorant. Most people are not even aware of it because most people are struggling. Most people aren't even thinking about it.
Well, that's my whole point.
Yeah.
That's my whole point is that most people are struggling. And I personally think I read like 50 articles on this fucking stupid banana. And
so therefore we shouldn't have art because most people are struggling?
No, I don't think no, absolutely not. I think we absolutely should have art. I think art, look, if you go and read, you know, Man's Search for Meaning, like it ends with the reason we are here is because of art and beauty. And And that is what it's all about. I think that what I just get a little caught up by is the fact that most people are struggling and someone wants to sell a banana for $120,000.
And someone wants to buy a stupid car for, you know how many more cars are sold for $120,000 than bananas?
Point, actually.
Or how many cameras or how many fancy clothes or diamond watches or
so the end net of this
there should be more bananas sold for $120,000, not less, because most people are consuming ridiculous things for $122,000, building lap pools in the basement of their apartments in Kiev and Moscow. I mean, people waste money on tremendous things, fur coats and raccoon coats and monkey coats.
Stefan, this has been eye-opening, as always. Anything you want to end with here, or should we just? Do you want me to get you another banana? Or
honestly, just get out there and buy more art.
Told me to remind you about something.
Malevich. Malevich's square, black and white. You know, I met these Russian tech billionaires once, and I got into this argument about that. We are not interested in art. I'm like, you should be. Like, why? I said, because Malevich basically did this crazy painting. It was like a black square, and I said it was the beginning of binary. He basically suggests a painting doesn't have to have color or figuration. It can have a geometric object, can be black or white. That is basically the beginning of the thinking of binary code, of zeros and ones. And I honestly think Malevich is like the precursor to the computer, because that break in creative thinking essentially took color and figuration and sort of created this very binary existence, this zero and one, this black and white. And I really think that was sort of one of the creative impulses for essentially everything that the 20th century is built on. And I said to these Russian tech billionaires, you should love art, you should respect Malevich, and you should be creative, and you should spend your Russian billions on art and culture instead of poo-pooing it and being ignorant about it. Just like all you people who think the banana is nothing. It's not. It's great. It's something.
Stefan Simkowitz, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nick Bilton.
Thanks to my guest today, Stefan Simkowitz, and of course, the banana that he ate. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find these on ApplePodcastRadio.com or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work. And thanks, of course, to my sponsors, Honey and Once Upon a Time in America. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. I'll see you next week for a very, very, very special guest.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.